Blog Talk Radio.
So no starting, general opening. I'll play it anyway, so hold on.
T-minus 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5. All three engines up and burning. 2, 1, 0, and lift off.
Coach on Fire Radio.
I am the tire.
Welcome, welcome, welcome. Hello, lovelies. Welcome to Mosaic of Love radio show, where everything love-related will be discussed and you have the opportunity to learn more about all the aspects of love. I am Laura Harju, a love coach and your guide on your journey towards your true love. You can find me at lovecoachlauraharju.com, and I'm also on Facebook at facebook.com/lovecoachlauraharju. I would love to hear from you. If you want to call into the show and participate, you can do it from US by calling to 646-716-7979. And outside from US, please join via sending me a message in Facebook to Love Coach Laura Harju. Today, I have the honor to have as my guest, psychologist and relationship researcher, Dr. Marisa T. Cohen. Marisa is a psychology professor and the co-founder of the Self-Awareness and Bonding Lab, which focuses on relationship research. Her specific research examines on people's perceptions of love and infidelity. She also has a line of research focused on consensual non-monogamy. In addition, Dr. Cohen is the author of From First Kiss to Forever, A Scientific Approach to Love, a book that relates relationship science research to everyday experiences and real relationship issues confronted by couples. Dr. Cohen actively presents her research from the field at both local and regional conferences. In addition to her research, she enjoys giving guest lectures on the application of the science to people's lives. And this is something that I really look forward to hearing more about today. So welcome, Marisa. Thank you for coming into the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I really look forward to hearing more about how to apply the science of love into our everyday life, because I have myself a scientific background being and studying at the university. So all these things is so interesting and intriguing. How to, when you are doing a research, so how do you use those results to make a difference in your own life? Because yes, just studying and getting results doesn't really make anything, but when you can put it in action, so then you can really make a change in the life. So
I absolutely love how you just said that. And the great thing about relationship science, or I would say the great thing about social sciences in general, and researchers who try to apply science to everyday life, is you can really see how the results can inform your everyday decisions. And relationship science is this wonderful, wonderful interdisciplinary field, and it covers areas such as psychology, sociology, biology, and philosophy, and all the research kind of converges in ways that helps you understand the choices you make for mate selection, as well as, you know, how we fall in love, what's going on within our bodies, and our perceptions of others. So it's really great because you can apply it and use it to affect you know, your interactions with others on an everyday basis.
And that's so interesting. I just love how, like, well, of course, all the woo-woo stuff as well, like your signs and your palms and all these things that are somehow revealing more about ourselves, I feel so interesting to learn more about. So when we are speaking about relationship science, so what kind of studies are conducted in the field?
Oh, wow. There's a lot, and it depends upon, you know, what subfield you're really looking at. So just to kind of give you some ideas, as I mentioned before, I said that it's kind of this interdisciplinary subject. And if you're looking, let's say, in the area of biology, right now they're doing a lot of studies looking at oxytocin, which we, you know, playfully call the cuddle chemical or the cuddle hormone. And it's something that's released by women in their breast milk. It's released during orgasm. It's released even when you hold a hug with a friend for a period of time. And, you know, it's released if you pet a dog. And it's something that really kind of adds to our drive to be close to others and encourages us to bond with one another. So you have biologists looking at hormones. You have people doing research on, you know, dying of a broken heart. That's actually a real syndrome. It's called stress-induced cardiomyopathy, and sometimes it's often misdiagnosed as a heart attack. But biologists are really looking into the ways that, you know, the stress of a loved one can impact us and actually affect the ability of it can enlarge our heart, and also affect the ability of our heart to pump blood, and can lead to, you know, like I mentioned, can be misdiagnosed as a heart attack. So you have biologists kind of looking at that. You have psychologists that are very interested, as I am, about our perceptions of others, how we relate to other people, our needs and our drives, such as the need for intimacy and the need for affiliation or forming friendships with others. You even have mathematicians that are, you know, looking for ways that we could kind of play a numbers game when it comes to love. Like, how many people should we date, and how can we mathematically define people that are out there for us in our dating pool? So there's just tons of studies in different areas, and I encourage everyone to be, you know, consumers of this research and seek it out and look in, you know, journal articles, or even just pop psychology is very helpful when they distill that information down, because I really think it can have an impact on how you live your life.
Absolutely, because when you understand more about yourself and the others, so it's easier for you to somehow relate how the other one is behaving and maybe understand why they are doing what they are doing, and that way we are capable of feeling more compassion towards others, and that really helps when it is about love.
Exactly. And just to give you like an example, you know, every semester I teach a course called Attachment and Attraction, and it looks at these different studies from relationship science. And I start off with two very basic examples that aren't necessarily looking at love per se, but our basic needs that we have regarding other individuals. And I mentioned them briefly before, but I want to, you know, kind of illustrate them, because it really shows, you know, how our everyday life interacts with this research. So the first need that we really have is the need for affiliation. And that's kind of our desire to seek out and kind of bond with other individuals. And this is something, it involves our need for support. And it's something that's kind of activated, especially during times of high uncertainty. Because the point of affiliation is not only to bond to another person, but uncertainty reduction. So, for example, I'm going to use a relevant example that I give a lot of my students here in New York City. So let's say you're on your way somewhere and you get on the train. And when you get on public transportation, something that you'll notice is that people are kind of closed off. You know, maybe they're playing on their smartphone. Maybe they're listening to music. They're kind of just focused internally on themselves. And a lot of this has to do with a principle in social psychology known as the urban overload hypothesis, where it's just there's so much coming at us at once that we kind of just retreat and we're focusing inward. And then all of a sudden, let's say that the train stops and maybe the lights go off on the train and you hear this really garbled message coming over the loudspeaker and you kind of, you can't really make out what it is. And you'll notice that people start to come out of, you know, they start to focus on one another. They might start to talk to one another, asking questions like, did you hear that? The announcement over the loudspeaker, do you know what's going on? What stop is next? Where are you going? How long do you think we're going to be on the train? So if people really, like during times of uncertainty when we don't know what's happening, that's when we really come together because we have this instinctual drive, this need for affiliation. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times it takes a tragedy to kind of bring people together. But that's something that's studied within this area of relationship science, why we actually need to bond to other people. And another one that I was just mentioned was the need for intimacy. And our need for intimacy is really why we might feel compelled to seek out a special person to share our innermost thoughts, our feelings, our desires, and if you fall in love, perhaps our lives with. So this kind of answers that age-old question of, is it better to have tons of casual friends, or is it better to have a few very close or intimate friendships? And in fact, the answer is the latter, is that we look to form close relationships with people that involve commitment and a level of self-disclosure where we feel that this person really has our best interests at heart. And if we need them, if times got tough, they would be there for us. So those are just two really basic examples of how relationship science can affect us and explain our behaviors.
Yeah, that's so important. And to, like, I mean, to do this research and to learn more about us. And yeah, I truly resonate with the second one that we need, like, it's more important to have a couple of really deep and close relationships than a lot of more, like, not so
casual. Yeah.
Yes, yes, that you are just saying how do you do and you get how do you do back and nothing else.
Yeah.
So, because that's something that I have had experience that I'm not that outward oriented. So I need more time to really bond with people. So it's easier for me to have a couple of close ones where I can share everything, trying to make these casual acquaintances to feel my surroundings. So yeah, I really resonate with that.
Right, that's great. And it's not to say that, you know, casual friendships or acquaintances aren't important. I mean, we're social beings. We're pre-programmed to be social beings. So, you know, just walking into your office day after day, you're going to, you know, create some work friendships. If you have the same commute every morning and run into the same people on the bus or the train or by the ferry, you're going to meet familiar faces and we will start to form these acquaintances. And those are great because they brighten up our day and they kind of expand our social circle. But as you said, it's really about those intimate relationships. Those are the ones that contribute most to our overall life satisfaction and sense of well-being, because those are the people that we can truly disclose who we are on the inside with.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's so important that we are able to be ourselves and not to have any kind of masks that causes stress or anything. So, yeah, very interesting stuff. I'm just curious. So, how did you get into this field?
I took a very, very atypical approach, and I am so happy where I am right now. But I was actually a bio major in college. My goal was to pursue a PhD in microbiology, and I've always had a very scientific and an analytical mind. I wanted to understand, using a scientific method, why things unfold the way they do. And I started to kind of realize over the course of my undergrad career that I wanted something a little bit more out of the, quote, hard science realm, but more social sciences, looking at behaviors. And I became enamored with teaching and education. So my PhD is actually in educational psychology. And of my graduate career, looking at how students learn from their teachers. So it's about relationships, but very, very different types of relationships, learning communities and students learning from teachers and that whole give and take relationship. And once I began teaching, I started teaching a couple of social psychology classes, and I took a continuing education course on human bonding, and I absolutely fell in love with it. So what I decided early on was that I would try to do a crossover study, kind of marrying my interests with now relationships and bonding and my background in educational psychology. So one of my first studies, and this was probably back in 2012 or 13, was looking at how important education is when you pursue a mate or when you try to find a match. So, for example, if you are someone who is very intrinsically interested in education and driven to pursue a higher education and focused on learning, are you then looking for someone who's very ambitious and driven? And in fact, one of these, this early study that I did with a colleague of mine, it did show that the people who were more intrinsically interested to gain knowledge and understand and focus on schoolwork, they were looking for that in a companion. So from there, it kind of just kept moving more and more into the relationship realm. And as you mentioned in the introduction, in 2014, I co-founded and now currently conduct my research out of the Self-Awareness and Bonding Lab. Our acronym is STABLE, and you can find Self-Awareness and Bonding Lab on Facebook. And there we're focused on just various different facets of relationships. You know, what makes relationships survive, what makes them successful, percept of our dates. And, you know, even I focus a lot on consensual non-monogamy. And we have a lot of students that work with us, and it's kind of whatever they're interested in, that's the line of research that we will pursue with them.
That's so important that we have somewhere to do these researches, because I think that there are several people who are interested in doing this kind of work. So it's so important that there is some way how to have the resources to do those kind of works. So, yeah, so important.
It's important too, because it's, you know, it's very important to get students, I think, as undergraduates, engaged in research and investigating to try to find data to investigate the questions that they come up with in their classes, the questions that they come up with in their everyday lives. So we're kind of, you know, we don't have a specific agenda in the lab. Rather, they have a question. If they're interested in looking at how does color influence attraction, or do long-distance relationships wind up being less successful than relationships where you live geographically close to one another? If they have the questions, I think it's so important to arm people with the ability to investigate the answers and come to some sort of conclusion themselves. It's empowering.
Absolutely. Yes. And that the fact that they are the questions that they have come up with their everyday life. So, because for me, well, of course, I was, thinking about math or some of the studies that I made in the university. So it rarely has anything to do with the real world. So I find it so important and intriguing so that I could have a question and I could come there and we could start doing the research. So how does this in real life happen? So, yeah, I really like that idea. We'll go and see more about the self-awareness and bonding lab to learn more about your work. So,
and we always
very intriguing.
We have studies. We're always looking for participants. We'll occasionally, on our Facebook page, we'll post links to surveys that people can participate in, or even just write in with some ideas that they want us to investigate or help us out with. We're a very community-oriented lab, and we're always looking to engage with others throughout our investigation.
Yeah, excellent. Looking forward to learning more about that.
Great.
Yeah. At this point, I want to share with the listeners that if you want to learn more about Marisa, so she has her own website, marisatcohen.com, where you can learn more about her. And I mentioned her book, From First Kiss to Forever, and that you can find from Facebook. And Marisa is sharing with us a free chapter from that book. So if you go to her website, marisatcohen.com, you can give your name and email address and you will get a free sample of her book. And that is something that I would want to learn a little bit more about. So how is this book relating to the topics that we have already discussed?
So this book, From First Kiss to Forever, it's a scientific, but it's not, it's something that it's, any reader can really enjoy. You don't need to be a scientist to be able to understand the book. But it's a way of distilling a lot of the scientific studies that are published in the area of relationship science and giving the readers important information from the studies and also relating the studies to the reader's everyday lives. And I cover topics from basically the beginning of relationships to the end of relationships. I talk about things like attachment styles. I talk about first dates, and that's actually the chapter that I'll be providing for free. It's about perceptions of the success of first dates. I talk about things like misattribution of arousal and how we read our bodies when we're on a dating experience with another person, and this can sometimes be misconstrued as love when in fact it's not. And I can get into that a bit more later. But it covers all different aspects of relationships. And at the end of each chapter, I provide readers with take-home tips, suggestions, and many times just questions that they can pose to either themselves or loved ones, and it doesn't have to be a romantic relationship, it can be a friendship as well, to just kind of think about how the science applies to them in their lives and how they can use the academic research in ways to enhance their relationships and make them more fulfilling. So it's kind of a cross between a scientific book and a self-help book, but it's really kind of made to ignite this desire to learn about relationships and what makes them successful.
I just love it. Yes, first of all, that it's about the research, so it's scientifically proved, and then that there is this how to use them in real life, because that's something that I am always looking forward, no matter what I'm doing, if I'm reading a book or listening a podcast or about some seminar. So I'm always waiting for the people to share with me how am I going to use this in my life. So the how is for me the most important thing in this. I usually understand the what and the why. And yeah, of course, mostly people are missing the how part, like in really specific, simple ways. How can I put this in action?
I completely agree with you. I think that's really important. I mean, you know, some studies can at times seem so abstract, and while they might be really, really interesting, you mm-hmm. just don't see how you could kind of get beyond that paper that you're reading and yeah. use it in some sort of meaningful way.
Exactly. Yeah. For the listeners, one more thing. So if you want to call into the show, the number is 646-716-7979. And if you want to raise your hand and ask a question or comment our discussion, so I think it's star one or pressing number one. And that's it from the US. And if you are joining us outside of US, so just send me a message in Facebook to Love Coach Laura Harju, and I will take those into the show as well. Now for you, Marisa, when you have been on a scientific field for a very long time, so is there some research that has had the biggest impact on your life?
That's such a great question. And I guess I'll talk about two different studies, both really, really important in this field. And I guess I'll start with John Gottman. And Dr. John Gottman is a researcher, and he, along with his wife, Julie Gottman, who's a clinician, they actually travel around the country and they do seminars and they train licensed clinicians to practice the Gottman approach. And while mm-hmm. I'm not a clinical therapist, I did have the opportunity, because I've read a lot of his research, to go to one of his seminars, and you know, I'm familiar with his work, and he is essentially able to predict divorce with over 90% accuracy, which is uh-huh. phenomenal, because in social science research, getting numbers like that is really challenging, because it's hard to predict people's behavior, you know, years down the road, but basically, what he does is he looks at conflict, and he's based out of the University of Washington, and he, in some of his studies, and he includes a lot of biological measures and physiological measures, looking at people's heart rate and how it elevates during discussion, but what he's really famous for, or at least in my mind, one of the things that I absolutely love, is his discussion of something known as the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. And in his case, he's discussing the Four Horsemen of a relationship apocalypse. And these are things that come out when you're arguing, when you're involved in conflict with your partner, and just by engaging or employing any of these four horsemen, this can essentially lead to the demise of your relationship. And I'll go through each of those because I think it's so powerful for us mm-hmm. to know. Because in looking at the way that, you know, we all fight. I started off by saying that we're all going to have some sort of disagreement, whether it's mm-hmm. with a friend or a romantic partner. And it's not whether or not we fight, but it's how we fight that matters. It's mm-hmm. what kind of tactics are we employing? And, you know, some of us are guilty, and I myself have been very guilty of employing some of these four horsemen, because when you sometimes just want to make a point, or when you're really, really angry, you're going to throw something out there that you know is going to work to kind of highlight what they are. So one of the four horsemen is criticism. And criticism, which I definitely know that I've done this before in fights, although I'm trying to be more aware of it, that's basically when you attack your partner's character. So, for example, if you have a significant other and you're living with him or her, and let's say in this example, someone's boyfriend constantly is leaving wet towels on the floor in the bathroom after he takes a shower. So criticism would basically be, you know, you always leave the towels on the floor because you're such a slob. And the issue with this is you're directing your criticism at the person rather than the behavior. Because what you're upset about is the fact that your partner isn't cleaning up after himself. But instead, you're making it about the partner and you're calling him a slob. And that's something that can be extremely, extremely hurtful. So first one, criticism. The second one is defensiveness. And defensiveness is basically, rather than taking responsibility for your actions in a fight, you kind of deflect and you call your partner out on something else. So, for example, let's go back to that previous one. Rather than the boyfriend just saying, you know what, you're right, I did leave the wet towel on the floor all day, I should have picked it up, he'll say something like, well, you took too long in the bathroom this morning, so I was running late, so what did you expect me to do? So the problem with defensiveness is, you're not owning up to your part in this issue, and you're making it about something else, about the other person. Third horseman is contempt, and this is actually, contempt is really, really similar to criticism, and contempt is basically when you say something hurtful, like criticism, but you're coming from a place of superiority. So this is kind of like adding on that extra level of like sarcasm. And I know a lot of people, you know, anecdotally, a lot of my friends are always telling me, oh, you know, I love when a guy is sarcastic because it shows that he's really witty and very intelligent. And there's a really fine line between wit and hurtful sarcasm. And you should be very wary. You should treat sarcasm as kind of like a red flag, because when a person is bitingly sarcastic, it leads to this contempt where they're kind of acting in a way that they're better than you. So an example is, you know, someone that says to you, well, of course you didn't get that promotion that you wanted. You're such a mess and you can't even get it together at home. You couldn't even put your towel away. So I'm going back to that towel example for some reason. and eventually, you know, the partner, they're collecting all this information over time. They're collecting all of these negative messages, and it's something that's going to stick and it's going to hurt. And the last of the four horsemen is stonewalling. And what I find really interesting is that I'm sure you've heard of the fight or flight response. And they teach about the fight or flight response. You know, when you're confronted by an issue, you either get prepared, like your adrenaline kicks in, and you either get prepared to fight or flee the situation. And I've heard about this in biology. I've heard about this in psychology. I heard about this in health class growing up. But what we don't talk about is the third alternative, where it's really fight, or flood. And flood is what leads to stonewalling, which is his fourth horseman. And it's when you're just so overcome that you just kind of shut down. And research has shown by Gottman and his colleagues that 85% of the time during arguments, it tends to be the man that stonewalls. So whereas criticism and contempt and defensiveness, that's employed by males and females, you tend to see that stonewalling is more often employed by males. And that's where you have, it's going to be sounding very like gender stereotypical here, which I try to avoid, but in this case it'll help me illustrate it, is you might have a woman kind of yelling at her partner, you know, you never put away the dishes, you never put away the dishes. And the man, if he's stonewalling, not really, that information isn't really getting in. So the argument isn't going to be productive at this point. And the best way to handle this is to walk away and take a break. And I know this is kind of counterintuitive, and people, when they wind up getting into a heated argument, they often want to rush to resolve the issue or get all of their feelings out. But if a person starts stonewalling, nothing helpful is going to happen at that point. You have to walk away. You have to let that physiological arousal level kind of dissipate a little bit. Get that adrenaline down, relax, and then once you have a clear head, you're going to have a much more productive and friendly discussion. So those are his four horsemen. I'm not going to get into, because, of course, it would take so much time, but he comes up with, and I have this also in my book, just like the antidote to the four horsemen, and just like, you know, as kind of a preview, a lot of it has to do with accepting responsibility and being respectful to your partner and focusing on the issue rather than just like hurling insults to get your point across. Because if you throw something out there just to make a point that isn't about the issue at hand, you know, like you sound just like your mother. If you're like intending to hurt your partner, you're going to hurt them and you're never going to resolve the issue. And they're going to, now the issue is going to become not only about the towel, but about your partner's lack of respect for you. And over time, that's going to erode the relationship. And, you know, how you mentioned before, and I mentioned as well, wanting to be able to connect the research to your everyday life. Studies have taught people about the four horsemen of the relationship apocalypse. And studies have shown that couples who are educated about these four horsemen and the antidotes to them, they tend to be a lot more constructive when they argue. And they tend to have a lot more relationship satisfaction. So just be aware of the way that you talk to other people and the way you fight with other people, because that can have a lasting impact on your future happiness and your relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Because, yeah, of course, with the common sense, we understand that if you are blaming your partner to be lazy or stupid or whatever, that has basically nothing to do with the fact that he has done. Of course, it's going to have a bigger impact to the other person than if you would have just said, like, I feel so annoyed when you are leaving those wet towels on the floor, so could you please pick them up? So it's just, well, this is part of the fact that what I always try to remind my clients to communicate, and with the nonviolent way that you would start the sentences, that what's bothering you and how you are feeling, because that will help to resolve the fight more like quicker. And yeah, most likely your man isn't going to stonewall you.
And I love how you said that. The way that you said that was, you know, I feel frustrated or I feel annoyed when you leave these towels. You're using an I message. So you're conveying, when you do this behavior, this is how this behavior makes me feel. So why this is a big issue, like why I can't, you know, because, you know, from the partner's point of view, it's just a towel. It's not that big a deal. But maybe this towel to you is indicative of your partner's overall approach to taking care of the house. Mm-hmm. And if you're using that I message, you're helping your partner understand how you feel, and you're communicating more effectively. And, you know, I don't blame people, and I have people come and tell me all the time, they're like, oh, I know my partner's Achilles heel. Like, I know it really bothers him, and I kind of insert that into an argument. And I understand that, you know, we get frustrated, we get heated, we want to just kind of shut someone down and just make the argument end quicker. So they kind of throw out those little bombs to kind of end it. But people don't realize the lasting impact that it's going to have on their relationship. Because, well, you feel momentary relief that you shut down this argument. The partner's going to remember all of those nasty, sarcastic comments. And it's going to shift the nature of your union.
Exactly. Yeah. So yeah, thank you so much for sharing those four horsemen, because I think already that to be aware of the different kind of ways that we are reacting to our loved ones, so that already helps. But yeah, to share the fact that there is an antidote to those, so we can learn to not do those. So, but you mentioned another research that has impacted you a lot.
Yes. I would just say that I'm really, really interested in the study about it. This is actually done all the way in 1974, and it's one of my favorite studies to tell my students about and to share with other people. And it has to do with something that I know that I was talking about before, called misattribution of arousal. And I don't mean arousal in like a sexual way. I mean arousal just like the alertness that our body is experiencing, like how alert, how awake. And misattribution of arousal is when we assign the cause of our arousal to something else. So just a quick, you know, easy example of what misattribution of arousal is. Let's say you have a quick breakfast and you go take an exam. And you sit down to take the exam and you notice that your stomach is starting to bother you. So you might misattribute this arousal to the exam and say, uh-oh, my stomach's kind of queasy. I didn't realize how nervous I was and how unprepared I felt for this exam. But really, the way that your stomach is feeling might have nothing to do with the exam itself and might have to do entirely with the breakfast you had that morning. So that's what misattribution of arousal is. Now to relate this to the famous bridge study that was done in 1974 by Dutton and Aaron, and I love this study. So what they did was they had a female research assistant stand on one of two bridges. And one of the bridges was shaky, high off the ground, above rocks and water. So, you know, imagine walking over like a suspension bridge that's very high off the ground. It'll increase your physiological arousal level. Your heart will start beating a little bit faster. You might get sweaty palms. You know, it's not a roller coaster, but, you know, you're gonna feel more arousal walking over this bridge. And the other bridge was a very low to the ground and stable, sturdy bridge. So as men walked across the bridge, this female would approach them and she would give them a picture. This is a type of projective test. She'd give them a picture and she would just say, can you stop a moment and just tell me what you see in this picture? And the picture would be like completely ambiguous. Like it might be a woman sitting on the couch. And the man would be able to tell any story that he would want to tell about that picture. And besides that, she would say, here's my phone number. If you have any questions about this study, feel free to call me tomorrow. And what the researchers were looking for were two things. One, they were interested in how many men were going to call the research assistant the next day, perhaps maybe to ask her out, but how many would follow up with her? And two, how much erotic or sexual stimuli would there be in the story that they create about this picture? And what they found was that there was a statistically significant difference between the people that were walking across the high off the ground shaky bridge and the people that were walking across that low to the ground sturdy bridge. So those who were on that high shaky bridge, they were more likely to call the woman the next day, and they also had more sexual imagery in their pictures. So what this is basically showing is that those who were on that shaky bridge, they got off the bridge, their heart was racing, their palms were sweating, they had this higher level of physiological arousal, and what they misattributed it to was feelings of love for that woman. So like, wow, I just saw that woman on the bridge. It was exhilarating. They didn't realize what they were reading from their body had to do with the bridge and not the woman. Okay, so we have this study. how the heck can this apply to my everyday life and my dating? And in fact, other researchers have actually, you know, taken this seminal study and applied it to married couples. Married couples show greater satisfaction after doing cardio than after doing yoga. People on dates report greater satisfaction if they went to go see a scary movie than if they went to see a romantic comedy. Now, of course, if you like scary movies, if you don't, stay away from them. But if you go on a date that increases your overall physiological arousal level, this can actually lead to misattribution of arousal. Now, if you have two people and there's no attraction and there's no common interest and they just don't seem to get along at all, you're not going to fall in love just because of like a shaky bridge, but it could enhance those underlying feelings. So for most people on a first date, go out to either dinner or drinks, perhaps using this research and keeping it in mind, a first date would be much more successful if you do something that increases your arousal level, like going for a hike if you like nature, or, you know, doing something a bit active. If the person, you have to kind of see what the other person is comfortable with, but if someone likes adventure, maybe indoor rock climbing, something like that will really lead to those feelings of, wow, I feel invigorated from this other person.
That's very interesting. What I have been, same thing is on the other side. I'm part of Toastmasters, and when we are doing public speaking or giving our speeches in the meeting, so when people are getting nervous, so on the other, like, on the other direction, to explain that, like, I'm excited and not that I'm nervous. So really, like, giving this arousal a different kind of explanation, so you will interpret it differently, more positively. And yeah, this is on the other side, that when you are doing something that will raise those arousals, so then you can interpret that the person you were with were the cause of this, and that's why, like, that way to give the other person more positive, like, give the picture of this other person will be more positive afterwards. So, yeah, very interesting study.
Yeah, and I love how you mentioned Toastmasters too. I mean, you bring up a good point. It's important to kind of realize what you're comfortable with and what the other person is comfortable with. So if you have someone who fears public speaking, a first date that, you know, probably wouldn't be the most effective would be going to some sort of like improv where you're trying improv. But, you know, within reason, if you can increase that physiological arousal, it will actually improve the first date experience. If those underlying feelings are there.
Absolutely. Yeah. So when you have met someone very interesting, you have maybe chat a little bit before setting up the date, and you know that you are kind of interested in the other person. So here's a good tip. Do something that will make you feel those arousals, so you have a better chance for the other person to think positively about you afterwards. So this is something that everybody can take from this. Excellent. Maybe we have about 5 minutes left, so what about Marisa? Is there anything else that when you have done those researches that you would want to share with the audience that they could implement in their lives right away when they are looking for their true love? Because that's one of my biggest things that I coach single women to do, to find their true love. So what would be your hot tip apart from this first date experience?
I think something that's very, very important is understanding yourself prior to pursuing a match. And study after study, and, you know, I could talk days about these studies, so I won't write it down. But, you know, contrary to the popular belief that opposites attract, it's not true. It's that birds of a feather flock together. So we like people like us. Now, I don't mean an identical carbon copy of ourselves, because our goal in a fulfilling relationship should be that we kind of push each other to be better versions of ourselves and expand our horizons. So if you like one type of music and the other person likes another type of music, that's not a reason to break up. It's great when you can, you know, introduce people to new things. But when I say similarity, I mean similarity on the core values and beliefs. That's where it's important. It's not those surface things. So it's about your views of the world, maybe your political leanings, if you're liberal or if you're conservative, if you're religious or if you're not religious. It's about, you know, maybe your emotional experience or your maturity, maybe your intelligence or your focus on academics. So you want people to view the world in a similar manner, because if you have a very big inherent mismatch in the relationship, it's really not going to work. Over time, it's going to lead to more problems. And coming back to how I started this is that as we mature, as we grow, as we gain life experience, we change. You know, we become hopefully better versions of ourselves as we learn more. So I think that, you know, when embarking on finding a mate, it's really important that you know what it is that you hold dear, what's important to you, and what you want out of life. So you can then find a partner that has those same goals and desires, and then you can work on pursuing them together. Because you will still change during the course of your relationship, but you want to grow together rather than grow apart. And the only way that you can do that is by taking inventory of what it is that's important to you early on. So don't be so quick to rush into a relationship with another person. You first have to work on that relationship with yourself.
Absolutely. Agreed. Yes. That's really something that we really need to, learn to know ourselves before we can know other or let others know ourselves. Because if you don't know what's important to you, so you will be constantly be bombarding with all these kind of things and you have no idea how to react. But when you know that what are the most important things to you, so when, for example, this first date is going to suggest to you Toastmasters, so when you know that public speaking isn't your thing, you are more able, like, capable to say, like, that's not really what I do. So in that case, you are more, you will get more pleasant experiences in life when you know what is in your liking and what's not. Even though I would highly suggest that everybody would come and try it out at least once.
Make a really great point. It's that we, you know, it is good to step out of our comfort zone. It is good to try new things within reason. You have to know, you know, like going back to core values and beliefs, if you are someone who is really, really religious and the other person isn't, and, you know, part of your identity is wrapped up with your religious faith, and the other person tries to kind of make you step out of that, it's not going to work, because that's not who you are at your core.
Exactly. Those are so important, and that has been something that I really encourage everybody to dig deep, like what is the most important thing for you, so that you know, and you recognize when somebody is trying to push you in the direction that you don't feel comfortable in going, so you can say no to them.
Exactly.
Good. Marisa, thank you so much for coming in. I really like this. I always love to learn more about these researches and really like taking them down to earth, like for the people to understand, not just the researchers, but everybody. So thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
And I really look forward to connecting more in the future as well. So for the listeners, when you want to learn more about Marissa, so go to marissatcohen.com, or in Facebook to learn more about her book, it's the facebook.com/firstkisstoforever. And go to Marissa's home website to get the free chapter from her book. Thank you so much for joining me today, and I wish you all a very nice time and have a lovely day. Thank you. Bye.
I can do anything. I can reach any goal today. I can do what I want. I can be what I want to be.
Coach on Fire Radio.
At Carl's Jr., we're pioneers of the great American burger. We're about quality, value, and taking a stand for your hard-earned dollar. That's why we made the $2.49 jalapeno double cheeseburger. It's the best burger for the price you ever had, with two charbroiled beef patties, jalapenos, and pepper jack cheese. Because if you don't stand for something, that means you're sitting. And that's just lazy. The $2.49 jalapeno double cheeseburger, the best $2.49 burger you ever had. Only at Carl's Jr. Price and participation may vary. Tax not included for a limited time only.
Progressive brings you Flowetry with Flo.
When Flo flows, she flows in the know. Mind ruminates, the rates. Shown them all, I heed the call. Seeing the rest, I choose the best. Sometimes it's ours, sometimes it's not. When the fox walks, is it called a fox trot? That's a real question.
Compare Progressive direct rates with competitors' rates. Visit Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.